Our series this summer, the series that we've been going through this summer is called Good Question, and it's based on questions that, as we were talking about it, Pastor Clayton pitched it to us like this, questions that wise people ask. And I looked at him and said, well, then why are you looking at me? That was a lot funnier than you thought it was. This morning, we're going to be going through a question. Questions that wise people ask are things that as we are we're looking for ways to be fully devoted followers of Jesus. What are the questions that wise people seeking after God, what are the questions that they ask? What are the things that they seek after? This morning, we're going to be studying Job chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. If you have a Bible with you, I'll invite you to turn there with me. I want to put this passage into a little bit of context later, but for the time being, we're just going to read through our focus passage this morning. I'll be reading out of the NIV today. That's Job chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. His wife said to him, Job, are you still maintaining your integrity? Curse God and die. He replied, you are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? I don't want to speak for you, but I find that to be an incredibly uncomfortable question. It's a very uncomfortable question to ask. And that's why we want to take a little bit of time to pursue it this morning, because as we're looking at questions that wise people ask as they seek after God, this is one of the big ones. But before we do that, I want to give you a little bit of a window into my life. As some of you are aware, I have two kids, Evan and Lucy. They are 6 and 4, and don't ask me how I made that, but there they are. It's all Nicola. It's all my wife. Thankfully, they're young enough that they're not going to get angry at me yet if I use them as a sermon illustration. I tried asking Lucy this morning, or last week as I was writing this sermon, hey, do you mind if I use a story about you in church? And she looks at me and she's like, are you going to tell them that I didn't clean my room this week? No, sweetie, I'm not going to tell them that you didn't clean your room this week. I love them way more than they could possibly imagine. They can't even wrap their minds around how much I love them. Growing up, I always had sort of this knowledge, and I thought I knew that my parents loved me, but I had no idea how much my parents loved me until I had kids of my own. I would walk over hot coals if it meant doing something good for my, or making sure that my kids were safe. If it meant keeping them safe, healthy, clothed in home, I would walk over hot coals for my kids. Sometimes I get the feeling that I am walking over hot coals when my son doesn't clean up his Lego blocks. If it means keeping them healthy and safe, I will do almost anything short of breaking the law, and some minor laws I might break, to keep them safe and healthy. I love them more than they could possibly imagine, and I'm doing my best to raise them to be well-adjusted and productive adults when they grow up. That's my job as a parent, is to raise well-adjusted, productive adults. We all get the opportunity to mess up with our kids in some special way. That's the parent's privilege. But I'm trying to raise them in such a way that they will be well-adjusted and productive. And I truly do want what's best for them. I want to pass on the knowledge and values that I believe are beneficial. Things that guide me in my life, mistakes that I've made. Don't do this. I've been down this road before. There are all sorts of things that we teach our kids, and for the most part, they're great about picking up on things. But there are a couple of areas that they're still working on. For instance, my daughter, Lucy. She is a lovely, imaginative, energetic, sweet little girl. But sometimes when we sit down at the dinner table, trying to get her to finish her meal is like entering into a high-stakes, high-profile hostage negotiation. It is tough sometimes to get that girl to eat her food. One night, just recently, not too long ago, we sat down to dinner, and I put Lucy's plate in front of her, and she looked at it, and then she looked at me, and she said, "What will I get if I finish this?" Huh? Nourished. I looked at her, and I said, "Well, sweetie, we don't have dessert or ice cream in the house, so you probably won't get anything." She looked back at her plate and cocked her head at me and then said without even a hint of irony, "Then why am I eating it? Why bother? It's a good thing I love her. If I'm not going to get rewarded for good behavior, then why am I bothering doing it? If I'm not going to get rewarded for eating my food, why am I going to slog through this thing that Mom slaved over if I'm not going to get dessert? There's no point." Adults can be like this sometimes, can't we? We very commonly expect rewards or benefits for good behavior, which is oftentimes the case. A lot of the times, what you put out is what you reap back. For instance, put in more time and effort at your job, and there's a good chance that you'll be noticed, given an opportunity for advancement. If you eat healthy and exercise, you can reasonably expect to live longer and better than if you didn't. If I buy my wife flowers once in a while and empty the dishwasher, I should be able to expect that she'll show some affection for me and maybe a little bit of extra leniency when I sort of am looking at that chop saw, the one that I've had my eye on for months. "I got you flowers. I emptied the dishwasher every once in a while. I deserve this." However, life doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes hardworking, well-meaning, diligent people get passed over for opportunities. Some diligent and healthy people get unexpected diagnoses. The harsh reality that I will only use a chop saw maybe twice in a decade does not justify me getting it, even if I am nice to my wife. People can do everything right and still experience trouble. That's the way the world works, unfortunately. Hardships and tragedy are just a part of our experience. In those moments when it feels like the entire world has just caved in around you, nothing makes sense. And we start to ask God some very pointed questions. We start to ask God questions like, "Why me? What did I do to deserve this? Why do bad things happen to good people? What's the point of obedience to God if I'm not going to be protected?" Maybe you've experienced a loss. Or maybe you've experienced trouble. Maybe you've experienced something painful that was completely unexpected. You'd done everything right, but still something happened, something outside of your control. And maybe you've wrestled with these questions. Our passage today drops us right into the middle of a situation just like that. Many of you are familiar with the story of Job, but for those of you who may not know the story or might need a refresher, we're just going to jump into what happened. The events of Job are set far, far, far back in the past, long before the time of Moses. If you are reading your Bible and you're wondering when Job may have taken place, it was probably around the time of the patriarchs. If you're not familiar with who the patriarchs are, go back to the very beginning of Genesis and read about some of those guys. Long, long ago, long before there was a law given, long before a nation called Israel was even called out of the desert, long before God gave people a law to show people what the standard of holiness before God is. Way, way, way back. That being said, we know that even without the law in the temple, Job was considered by God to be a righteous man. We see this immediately in verse 1 where it says, "This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and he shunned evil." Because Job respected and feared God, he was considered blameless. He was considered righteous. He was considered holy before God. We also know that Job was immensely successful. Verses 2 and 3 describe Job's family and wealth, concluding by saying he was the greatest man among all the people of the East. That's not like going and saying that I've got the biggest house in Devon. This is an entire region. He was the richest man in his entire region. Out of all of Alberta, this man was the most famous and most successful. Righteous and successful. Job has it all. He's respected by the people around him. He wants for nothing. He's secure. And what's more, he's considered by God himself to be blameless and upright. Job has literally everything going his way at the beginning of his story. Everything. And so the story goes that on a particular day, God was holding court in heaven, and all the angels came to present themselves before him like a huge group of heavenly administrators. And they start to give their reports. And among them is one that the Bible identifies as Satan. Now, normally when we see that word, when we see that, we attribute it to a name. We attribute it to the adversary, the devil, Satan. However, in the book of Job, it's used a little bit differently. It's not so much a name as it is a position. The word Satan, or the way that it's pronounced in the Hebrew, is the Hebrew word Satan. It's actually used to describe a challenger or an accuser or an adversary. It's not a name so much as it is a position. So in this heavenly administration, there are angels who are in charge of many, many things, and this one is assigned as the adversary. The exchange between the accuser, we're going to use the word the accuser this morning. The exchange between God and the accuser essentially boils down to this. God acknowledges Job before the accuser as a righteous servant who he is pleased with. The accuser challenges God by saying that Job only serves God because he's protected and successful and secure. Of course he fears you. Of course he serves you. He's got everything. He's got no reason to turn away from you. You provide everything for him. However, if all of his blessings were taken away, then I'm telling you right now, surely God would curse, or Job would curse you to your face. So God allows the destruction of Job's flocks, his herds, his property, his children, but does not allow the man himself to be harmed. Naturally, Job is devastated. This is not something that he just takes in stride. He doesn't just shrug it off. He is devastated. But he doesn't curse God. Shortly after this, God is holding court in heaven again, and the accuser presents himself again. And God again praises Job for maintaining his integrity in the face of destruction. But the accuser says that although Job has lost much, he has remained loyal to God because he values his own skin. You haven't struck out against the man himself. This time, God hands Job over to the accuser on the condition that he not be killed. You can't kill the man, otherwise this whole thing is moot. Chapter 2, verse 7 says, "So Satan went out of the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the crown of his head." It's shown later on that Job is sitting outside of the city on a heap of ash, scratching himself with a piece of pottery just to try and give himself some relief from the aching itch that he gets from this. In this picture, we see somebody who is not just sick, but somebody who's been cast out. And in those days, an ash pile outside of the city typically meant the city dump. just outside of the walls. It was a place that was perpetually on fire. If you've got refuse that you need to get rid of from a walled city, nobody knows what a landfill is at this point in time. So what do? We dump it outside and we burn it all. And where do we send the people who have infectious diseases? Well, we don't have a ward for that here. We don't have a hospital that we can send them to. They need to be in quarantine, but we're in a walled city. We're all in quarantine. So keeping this person within the walls, we're all at risk. So they send Job, this person who used to be highly regarded, this person who used to be rich, successful, secure. People came to him for his wisdom. He's been sent outside of the city to go sit in the dump. He's truly a man who has fallen from grace. Within two chapters, Job has gone from being the greatest man among his people to a destitute outcast living in pain and squalor. And so we pick up in chapter 2, verse 9, as Job's wife says this to him, "Are you still maintaining your integrity? Curse God and die." There's a lot to unpack in that verse. That being said, it's not hard to see where she's coming from, is it? Everything up until now has made sense. We kept our noses clean, and so it makes sense that we were successful and safe. But now nothing makes sense. I'm confused, I'm angry, I'm hurt. I don't know what to do. Everything that I knew is just, it's gone. I have no idea what to think anymore. I want to hold that thought for a second because we're going to go in a bit of a different direction for a second. Growing up, my family had a lot of Disney movies, and one of them that me and my sisters would watch all the time because my youngest sister was really, really into it was the Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh. Going from Job to this seems like a bit of a gear shift. And one scene from that movie kept popping into my head as I was preparing to preach this week. If you're familiar with the Winnie the Pooh stories, you'll know we have him up on the screen right now. You know the character of Rabbit, yes? He's the youth pastor, go with it. You know the character of Rabbit. And you'll know that Rabbit is probably the most responsible character in the entire cast. He's polite, he's well-organized, hard-working, maybe a little pretentious at times, but overall, very responsible, very orderly. In the scene that I'm thinking of, and unfortunately I couldn't find a picture of it because Disney has copyright stuff over everything, they own half the world, but that's just me complaining, I'm sorry, you didn't need to hear that. In the scene that I'm thinking of, it comes in one of the stories of this movie, and in this scene, Rabbit, having gone through his entire harvest season, it's wintertime right now, he's out on the lake and he's skating by himself. Skating peacefully on his own. So on this day with the harvest over and his home in order, he's out enjoying some well-reserved rest and relaxation. What a perfect day, peace and quiet. As he's gracefully and contentedly skating on the ice, the serenity is suddenly broken when the tiger, Tigger, suddenly crashes into him from out of nowhere, sending Rabbit flying across the ice, crashing through his door and destroying his entire house. Everything on the walls falls down, furniture broken, door broken, middle of winter, that's going to be cheap to repair. As he sits in the rubble of his ruined home, he turns his face to the sky and laments, "Why does it always have to be me? Why, oh why, oh why?" The poor guy was just quietly staying in his lane. And out of nowhere, and without reason, disaster struck. In a much, much, much more serious way, I think this is where Job's wife is in this verse. Why us? Why now? Why this? In her mind, the world runs on justice. If you do good, then you get good. If you do wrong, then you get punished. That's her worldview. She's completely confused, and so she lashes out at her husband. Job, you did everything right. You did nothing to deserve this. And you know, what's more, you know you did nothing to deserve this. But it happened anyway. What's the point of your integrity before God? He struck you down, punished you for no reason. It's like it's amusing for him to watch you suffer. You're going out, so you may as well go out with a scrap of your dignity left intact. Rather than groveling before a cruel God, why don't you just curse him to your face? Tell him how you really feel about him. If this is your reward for being righteous, why bother? If this is your reward for being righteous, why bother? How easy is it to go there when we're hurting? To start asking why this is happening or how a loving God could possibly let this happen to us. Like Job's wife, we can very naturally question God's justice when we experience pain or loss. If God is just, shouldn't that mean that people get what they deserve? If God is just, why do bad things happen to good people? And in the middle of his suffering, this is how Job answers. He replied, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? He turns the question around. He turns the question around from why me, and he turns it right on its head, and he says, why not me? Why not me? Instead of asking why bad things happen to good people, Job turns the question on its head and asks, why should righteous people prosper? In this moment, we see a big difference between Job and his wife. This whole story, this whole interaction between God and the accuser has been hanging on this one moment. It's been hanging on this whole thing. The only reason this man is faithful to you is because of what you give him. The whole story revolves around that. If Job is only faithful to God because of what he gives him, then the accuser wins in the end. The accuser is right. This wise, righteous man is only righteous for reward. Then what's the point if there is no reward? In this moment, again, we see that difference. Job has proven that his faith goes beyond self-preservation. Job has proven that his faith goes beyond what can you give me. Job doesn't serve God to be rewarded. Instead, Job understands that God is to be served in all circumstances. Why hold on to my integrity? No. The question is, how could I possibly reject God? He's God, I'm not. And no matter what, I will submit to his wisdom. Even at the lowest point of his entire life, Job does not curse God. And because of that, he is still blessed by God by being recognized as a man who is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Even at his lowest, God still blesses Job. That being said, here's something else that Job doesn't do. Job doesn't enjoy this. He doesn't enjoy his suffering. Make no mistake, Job is in the greatest physical, emotional, mental anguish of his life. He's lost his wealth, his status, his community, his children. His marriage is breaking down. His health is in shambles. He's experiencing physical pain without relief. And on top of this, the people who were supposed to be his friends, we'll see later on in the book, the people who are supposed to be his friends will spend the next 30-odd chapters of the book of Job trying to tell Job why all of this is his fault. There is no stiff upper lip in this story. There is no silver lining. In chapter 3, Job cries out and expresses the pain that he's going through, saying this, "Sighing has become my daily food. My groans pour out like water. What I feared has come to me. What I dreaded has happened to me. I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest, only turmoil." Does that sound like somebody who's contemplatively taking his pain and suffering in stride? That's not a rhetorical question. Does that sound like somebody who's like okay with what's going on? No. No, he is not okay with what's going on. Job is allowed to experience his loss without the pressure of making the best of it. He doesn't have to search for a silver lining in this whole thing. He is the ultimate example for us of how a righteous man can still suffer. For us, this means that when we experience trouble and loss, we don't need to pretend that things are okay. It is okay to not be okay and still believe in God. Suffering is not something that needs to be hidden because it's not something that's shameful. Job didn't do anything to deserve it. So why would he hide his pain like it's something that he's embarrassed of? It didn't come on him because of something that he did. It just happened. He doesn't need to hide that. There's no rule that says people who trust God need to suffer in silence. But like Job, even when we suffer, we can still maintain our faith in God and fully put our faith in Him no matter the circumstances. There's something very, very uncomfortable about the book of Job. There's something very uncomfortable about Job's story, and it's this. It doesn't try to give us a reason for suffering. It doesn't try to give us a reason for suffering in the world or even try to defend the justice of God, trying to convince us that he's fair. It doesn't do that. Instead, the story of Job challenges us to trust that God is wise. And that by extension, if God is wise, then God is also just. It puts our place in the world into perspective, saying that no matter what, God is to be respected and obeyed. He understands what's going on in the grand scheme of things. I can only see this little piece of it in my life. It's the same thing as going and saying, well, I know everything that's going on in the church, right? No, I don't. I don't know what goes on in your house when you go home. I don't know what happens when you get into your car. Half of you, I don't even know what direction you take home. I don't know everything that goes on there. So how could I possibly put myself into a position where I can tell God, who knows everything, how can I put myself into a position to tell God what's best, even when it comes to my life? That's where the book of Job lands. God is in control, and we need to trust him, even in the turmoil. Jesus said this to his disciples on the night before he was crucified. I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. He doesn't say, if you have troubles, take heart. He says that you will have troubles. You will experience loss. You will experience heartache and problems that are completely undeserved. The world is a broken place that is more complex than we could possibly even imagine. It's chaos. But even in that, Jesus has promised that he is in control. We can rest in the knowledge that even though things are painful now, even though things are confusing now, that God sees the whole picture. When we trust in the wisdom of God, there are some significant things that happen in our lives. And the first one is this. When we trust in the wisdom of God, we're given hope for the future. 2 Corinthians 4:18 says this, "So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but what is unseen, since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal." While the pain of the situation may not be made lighter with this knowledge, we are better able to endure tragedy if we understand that this world is temporary. It doesn't take the pain away. I am not in any way, shape, or form trying to tell you to suck it up because this place isn't going to last forever. That's not what Job did. Suffering is a real thing. And I honestly believe that God grieves with us as we go through those things. But in that pain, in that suffering, in this world, we understand that this is a temporary stop before our eternal home. And knowing that, we have hope for a future without pain. We have hope for a future without suffering. We have hope for a future without brokenness. We have hope for a future with a restored relationship with the God who created us. Second, we have hope for ourselves. We have hope for the future. But when we trust in the wisdom of God, because we have that hope for the future, we are better equipped to walk alongside those who suffer. We are better equipped to walk beside suffering people. When Job's friends first came to him, they started out by doing the best thing they could have possibly done. They mourned with him. They didn't say anything. They saw his situation. They immediately started crying along with him, and then for 7 days and 7 nights, they sat in the ashes with Job, and they said nothing. And the Bible says in chapter 2, in Job chapter 2, it says, "For they saw the great anguish that Job was in." No words could fix him at that point. There was nothing that anybody could say that was going to be the magic word that goes and says, "Hey, Job, I know what you're going through right now, buddy. But have you thought about it like this?" They didn't do that. They sat and they mourned with him. The second they started trying to help Job by offering solutions, they became useless, and God even became angry with them. We cannot fix the pain and the chaos in this world, so why pretend that we can? What we can do, is acknowledge the pain of others. Enter into the darkness with them and gently help them pick up the pieces and build them up again. There's nothing that's going to go and take that hurt away. But we can help to rebuild broken people, offering the hope that we have. We can share the hope that we have with others who suffer. What are the troubles that you're facing? What have you had to endure? Who do you know that's going through troubles right now? Who do you know that has gone through troubles in the past? How has that shaped your understanding of who God is? Has it caused you to question his justice? Has it made you question his love? Has it made you wonder if faith has a point? In the middle of it all, have you wondered what the point of faith is? If so, this story shows you that you are not alone. But it also encourages you to hang on to your faith, because God knows what you're going through, and God sees the whole picture. It hurts now, but you can trust that in the end, there is hope for the future. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? The story of Job shows us that suffering is a universal reality in our world. It can and will happen to anyone, but it also shows us that even in the chaos, we can still trust that God, in his wisdom, is still in control. Would you pray with me, please?